This is Carol Foster of 2 Timothy 2:15 Resources, and I am so excited that you're going to join me today as we study God's Word. The response new Messianic believers give when asked why they initially visited a Messianic congregation is, "We knew there had to be more." As we study together, we will begin to see that yes, indeed, there has to be more. For additional study aids to assist you in studying along with us, go to our website, sectim.org. When we were together last time, we began to look closely at Shemot, or Exodus, chapter 17. We found that this chapter in Shemot is divided into two different sections. The first section covered verses 1 through 7, and it recounted the events leading up to Moshe, or Moses, striking the rock at Hebron. The people were again grumbling and murmuring about the lack of. This seems to have been a theme throughout their years in the desert. God had taken them out of Egypt through the parting of the Red Sea and had provided daily manna for them to eat. However, this time it was not only grumbling and murmuring. They now were becoming contentious, that is, angry, quarrelsome, and argumentative. This came to the point that Moshe even cried out to Jehovah, "What shall I do with these people? A little more and they will stone me." They had the presence of the Lord in the clouds by day and the pillar of fire by night. But yet they tested the Lord, Jehovah Yireh, the God who provides, to see if he was going to do what he said he would do. Their cry was, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Moshe named the place where this happened Massa, which means temptation, and Meribah, which means contention or strife. We discovered that just as Israel found themselves in a place of dryness and were thirsting, we can find ourselves in a dry and thirsty place. The water represents the washing of the Word. It refreshes and satisfies the thirsting of our souls. We need to keep ourselves in the Word. Let it fill us with hope, direction, and comfort. According to 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, we read, "All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." Are you adequately equipped for every good work that Jehovah has put before you? Run into your tower of protection. Stay in the Word. May it be something that you not only hear and read, but that it becomes part of your very being, so that you may be adequately equipped for whatever this world brings your way. Our next section in Shemot, or Exodus chapter 17, are verses 8 through 16. Now, there's a complete change of subject and events between verse 7 and verse 8. I want to read this to you. Listen carefully. "Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand.' Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven.' Moses built an altar and named it, 'The Lord is my banner.' And he said, 'The Lord has sworn, the Lord will war against Amalek from generation to generation.'" We want to begin by asking questions of our text. When did this event take place? Now, this is important to know as it not only gives us an idea when this occurred in the time in the desert, but also tells us what Jehovah had already done for them. Remember, Jehovah Yireh, God has provided. This event took place after they were released from Egypt, after all the plagues, after the Passover, and after the parting of the Red Sea. This occurred after the Lord showed himself in the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of clouds by day. It occurred after the singing, praising, worshiping, and dancing before the Lord. It happened after the bitter waters of Marah were turned sweet. It happened after the commandments for health. It also happened after they had been led to the oasis of 12 wells of water and the palm trees. After the provision of manna in the morning and the provision of quail in the evening. It also happened after the miracle of provisions for the Sabbath. The next question that we ought to ask of the text is, where did this battle take place and why is this important? The battle took place in Rephidim. Determining the location of the battle is important to help us to determine the Exodus route. It is only one stop next to the wilderness of Sinai. Now this means that Rephidim and the wilderness of Sinai must be on the same side of Mount Sinai, which is the east side, or at least in close proximity. Israel spent 3 days there. Now these were days 17 and 19 from the Red Sea crossing. Rephidim is also an important stop in Hebrew history of not just the Exodus, but of other events as well. Three key events occurred at Rephidim. One was the complaint of no water. Now, we read this in Shemot or Exodus chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. It was also the place that the Amalekites attacked Israel, and Moshe climbed a hill and held his hands up in the air in order for Yehoshua to win the battle. Then we read in Shemot 18, verses 8 through 16, that after winning the battle, Moshe built a memorial altar. Now, this is the study for this session. After the three episodes that tell about the problem of hunger and thirst in the wilderness, two other kinds of problems are mentioned, namely warfare with a hostile desert tribe and the increasing difficulty of organizing the Israelites for self-government. It's significant that all three kinds of problems are included in the story of the journey to Sinai. They show the importance of establishing this new relationship between Moshe and the people before arriving at Mount Sinai. The story of Israel's battle with the Amalekites preserves an ancient tradition of enmity between the descendants of Yaakov, Jacob, and the descendants of Esau. We can read this in Bereshit, or Genesis 36, verses 15 through 16, and this identifies Amalek as Esau's grandson. The importance of this story is that it reveals another kind of problem in the wilderness, namely the constant threat of nomadic tribes. It represents the problems threatening the Israelites from the outside, in contrast to the internal problems of finding food and water and becoming organized as a nation. Its place in the books of Exodus also shows how the relationship between Moshe and his people had to be worked out. The people had to learn by experience that Jehovah would take care of his people and that Moshe was the man whom he had chosen to lead them. If we were to give a section title to these final 9 verses in Shemot 17, it might be Warfare with Amalekites, or maybe the Amalekites are defeated. Either one would be very appropriate. Moshe did not mention the reason for the Amalekites' attack on Israel, but even the very first readers of Moshe's writings would have known something of the history of the enmity between Israel that carried on from the Esau-Yaakov rivalry described in Genesis, and something of the Amalekite methods of attack. Amalek was a grandson of Esau. We can read this in Bereshit 36, verse 12. And his descendants organized themselves into a very early national nomadic group. And this group lived partly by attacking other population groups and plundering their wealth. We can read this in Judges chapter 3, verse 13. The Amalekites had domesticated the camel and used its swiftness effectively in surprise attacks. Not only did the Amalekites attack Israel at Rephidim, but a year later they attacked them again at Hormah, when the Israelites had been driven out of southern Canaan and were on the run after their foolish attempt to enter the Promised Land in spite of God's command through Moshe that they should not do this. I think we all know the story of the 12 spies that went into the Promised Land and came back with two different recommendations. I want to read this account so that we can remain in context as to who the Amalekites were and what their history with Israel was. We find this account in Numbers chapter 14. 10 of the 12 spies gave a report of giants, the sons of Nephilim, inhabited the land, and that it was death to try to enter into the land. If you're unfamiliar with the Nephilim, read Bereshit chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. These were the angels who left their proper abode and took the daughters of men as wives. Two of the spies, Yehoshua and Caleb, brought back a good report and encouraged the Israelites to go into the land and take it as the Lord had commanded them. Again, we read about grumbling against Moshe and Aaron. No longer were they only complaining and grumbling about food and water. They now added the issue of the giants in the land and their disbelief that God would give them the victory. They complained to Moshe, saying, "What would we have died in the land of Egypt? Or what we had died in this wilderness? Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moshe and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. The Lord said to Moshe, "How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?" We then read in verses 11 and 12 that the anger of the Lord was voiced against them. He said, "I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them. I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they." Moshe pleaded with God, saying that the Egyptians would hear of this and that the Lord would not be able to keep his people into the land that he had promised them. He also reminded God of what he had promised and prayed that he would pardon or forgive their iniquity of the people, not by anything that they had done or changed, but because of who God had shown himself to be, and the fact that he had pardoned all of their other testing along the way from Egypt. Then we read that the Lord responded in verses 20 through 23 with, "I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it." The Lord did indeed forgive their testing, but there were ramifications to their actions, both for those that doubted and for the two that had faith and trust. None of those that were 20 years old or older would enter into the Promised Land, and their children would wander for a total of 40 years in the desert. The number 40 is very important to note, as this is the number of days that the spies spent spying out the land. Next, we see that God rewarded the faithfulness of Caleb, saying in verse 24, "But my servant Caleb, because he's had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it." We also read about the fate of Yehoshua in verse 38. "But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh remained alive out of those men who had went to spy out the land." We also read in verses 36 and 37, "As for the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, and who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report of the land died by a plague before the Lord." Next in our timeline of events, we see how the people responded to God's discipline and then God's response to them. I'm going to read verses 39 through 43. So listen closely. "When Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. In the evening, however, they rose up and went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, 'Here we are. We've indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised.' But Moses said, 'Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Don't go up, or you will be struck down before your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there in front of you, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you.' But they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses left the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah." The Amalekites may have traveled further south on this occasion than was their usual habit in order to attack the Israelites, perhaps because they had heard that Israel was far from any population center and relatively defenseless. The fact is that following this encounter, the Israelites lost the Amalekites, except when Moses kept the staff of God elevated, indicates the basic military superiority of the Amalekites to the Israelites, something they presumably were counting on in launching this raid in the first place. We studied this earlier in this session in Shemot 14. Now that we understand the history between Amalek and Israel, let's return to our focal passage and the first time that we hear the name of Jehovah Nissi, "God is my banner." I want to read these final verses again from Shemot 14 so that we can remain in context. "Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose men for us, go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with God's staff in my hand.' Yehoshua did as Moshe had told him and fought with Amalek. Then Moshe, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. When Moshe raised his hand, Israel prevailed, and when he let it down, Amalek prevailed. However, Moshe's hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, the one on one side and the other on the other, so that his hand stayed steady until sunset. Then Yehoshua defeated Amalek, putting their people to the sword. Adonai said to Moshe, 'Write this in a book to be remembered, and tell it to Yehoshua. I will completely blot out any memory of Amalek from under heaven.' Moshe built an altar, and he called it Adonai Nissi, or Adonai is my banner and or miracle, and said, 'Because their hand was against the throne of Jehovah, Adonai will fight Amalek generation after generation.'" I think it's interesting that the Israelites had a day to prepare for battle. The Amalekites may have arrived gradually at Rephidim, signaling their presence early, or else advanced parties may have encountered the Israelites, then gone north to get the main body of warriors with which to engage them, thus alerting the Israelites and allowing them time to prepare. Another possibility is that the Amalekites may have announced to the Israelites that if they did not surrender their valuables, they would be attacked the next day. At any rate, Yehoshua had to pull together an army with a single day's notice, and part of the criteria he used for selecting fighters may well have been simply identifying those who had a sword. Many men had probably begun to carry some sort of knife or short swords, but it's hard to imagine that the Egyptians had allowed the Israelites much in the way of weapons while they were still in Egypt. Whatever weapons the men now owned had probably been manufactured in the wilderness and may not have been of the highest quality, and almost surely not the greatest quantity. This is the first account in Shemot of Moshe's making special use of the staff of Jehovah without being instructed by Jehovah to do so. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the mountain with the staff of God in my hands. Do you remember reading that? Does this wording mean that he was now confident in his own authority to use the staff as he saw fit? I don't think so. By this time, Moshe expected people to realize that he would never use the staff unless commissioned by Jehovah to do so. In this relatively brief account of Israel's first warfare, many potential supportive details are omitted. And one of them surely is the fact that Jehovah was behind the call to battle and the determination to use a divine staff as a symbol of Jehovah's presence with the people during the battle. The next day the battle began, with Yehoshua leading the Israelite army on the battleground, with Moshe on top of the hill, with Aaron and Hur accompanying him. Aaron is already well known as Moshe's brother and the co-leader of the Israelite Exodus. But Hur is introduced here for the very first time. More importantly, Josephus identifies him as the husband of Miriam. This war was an Israelite holy war, and it was God's war. God reinforced this clearly in the minds of Moses and Aaron and Hur, as well as the Israelite army, by identifying the position of the staff with the success of the army. It was important the Israelites understand unmistakably that the only reason they could win against the Amalekites was that God was fighting for them. He was giving them the victory. Moshe's staff functioned in the case of this battle just as it had in the case of the plagues. As long as the staff of Jehovah was raised high, just as in the Egyptian plagues and the miracle of the water from the rock immediately prior, Jehovah's decisive role was properly acknowledged by the position of the staff in relationship to the army's success, or lack of it. When the staff was raised, the army prevailed, and when the staff was lowered, because Moshe grew tired, the Amalekites were winning. Thus, the staff portrayed Jehovah's sovereignty in the consequences of battle. By nighttime, this arrangement, fulfilling the purpose of having the staff along for the battle, resulted in a total victory for Israel over the Amalekites. Now, we understand that Moshe did not actually write the details of this event in a book, but he may have written it on a scroll, or it may have been instructions to include in the Pentateuch when he wrote it. Actually, the point is to make sure that Yehoshua hears it. Represents a way of saying that Yehoshua would have among his many assignments as Moshe's successor to be on the lookout for the Amalekites, who were from that point on enemies of the Israelites, who because of their treachery were to be considered in the same category as the Canaanites, part of a culture fit for extermination. This is the earliest passage in the Pentateuch to imply that Yehoshua would succeed Moshe as Israel's leader. A further assumption was that Yehoshua would pass on never to destroy Amalek during his lifetime, but left the task to his ancestors, which were the kings Shaul and David, who actually finished the job. Jehovah's prediction, "I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven," constitutes a very early prophecy against a foreign nation, a common form of prophecy that can be found in other books. Such prophecies predict the destruction or suppression of an army of Israel, and thus automatically an enemy of God, at some time in God's choosing in the future. Thank you for joining us today as we delve into the beautiful truths of God's Word to indeed discover that there has to be more. I pray that the Word applied to your daily life will bring a deeper understanding of His love letter written just to you. Let me remind you that we have additional study aids to assist you with our studies together on our website, secTIM.org. May this day fill you with the love of God, joy, and shalom. Nothing missing, nothing broken in your life.